This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Tēnā tātou katoa. Nō mai hoki mai ki tēnei kaupapa kōrero or the Physics Room. Nō mai, whakarongo mai, whakatau mai. My name is Abby Kinane and I'm the director of the Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa. Based in central Ōtautahi since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to enable creative and professional development and work to support the acknowledgement and understanding of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production, and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate.
Welcome to episode 58 of Art Not Science. My name is Amy Wang, and I'm the curator at the Physics Room. In this episode, we'll be sharing with you a recent talk, Interrogating Notions of Peace, by Maktis Azamandi. Maktis is a senior lecturer in educational studies and leadership at the University of Canterbury, where she also serves as the coordinator for the Bachelor of Youth and Community Leadership Program. After earning her PhD from the National Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Otago, she held a position as Assistant Professor at DePauw University. Additionally, she has taught in Germany and Denmark. Her research focuses on addressing the notable absence of race in peace and conflict studies, alongside examining the interplay between colonisation, imperialism, and white supremacy in the context of peace and violence. Her current research extends beyond peace and conflict studies, encompassing abolition and the envisioning of a war-free world, with a focus on confronting the structural violence of capitalism, racism, and militarization to dismantle oppressive systems. In addition to her work on peace and conflict studies, she also works on the politics of memorialization in Spain and Aotearoa, New Zealand. Her scholarly works delve into resistance to monuments and uncover the colonial inscriptions embedded within urban landscapes. She is one of the editors of the book Decolonize the City, Zur Kolonialität der Stadt, Gespräche aus Handlungen, Perspektiven. This talk offers an exploration into the intricacies of peace against a backdrop of genocide and colonial violence in the context of the grim realities of war, particularly evident in regions like Gaza. This talk will examine prevailing notions of peace, unveiling the hidden violence perpetuated by colonialism and imperialism. The talk will draw on personal narratives and art made in resistance to challenge conventional understandings of peace and violence, emphasizing the practice of hope as a discipline, as a pathway towards imagining a world without war. This talk was given as part of the Physics Room's ongoing commitment to sharing our space and resources to educate ourselves and our community about the occupation of Palestine and to build resistance to colonial injustice at home in Aotearoa and globally. Now, let's hear from Maktis.
Kia ora tātou. Thank you all for coming. I'll start off by talking a little bit about who I am and how this talk maybe came about. So I'm Maktis Azamandi. I currently work at the University of Canterbury. I'm a lecturer there in the Faculty of Education, but I am a trained peace and conflict studies scholar. So my PhD was in peace and conflict studies. My master's degree was in peace and conflict studies. My undergraduate degree is in politics, Jewish studies, and English. So very much a political science background with a focus on peace. I have engaged in Palestine solidarity work for now 22 years. That makes me sound and feel really old. But I first went to Palestine in 2003 as a, I don't remember quite if I was 19 or 20. And I've drawn quite a bit of what I'm going to talk about from those experiences and memories from the last 20 years, I've included photographs, photo montages of my that I created and that a friend of mine created who was in Palestine at the same time, but who I only met afterwards in the non-Palestine context of peace studies. So I wanted to talk about this notion of peace, which feels quite cynical in this moment in time, but that's what I do. I study peace and conflict studies. I like thinking about ideas and discourse and how we make sense of words and why it's so difficult to talk about peace and why Palestine has pretty much since its inception and since the beginning of the occupation been such an exception to Western notions of universal peace. So I'm a peace studies person, which is slightly different from being an international relations person. So international relations is the study of basically nations. And understanding peace in international relations has always been around this notion of stability. So they look at sovereign notions of how do countries have sovereign borders and come to govern themselves, and then how do they engage with each other. Peace studies are slightly different because it has a normative approach. So peace studies has always been different from international relations because they take a moral stance on the issue of war. So they don't think that war is just something that has to happen because countries just can't help themselves, but that war happens and that it is inevitable and that maybe we should engage in ways of living together that can minimize or eradicate war. Now, that doesn't mean that every peace scholar is a pacifist. That's by no means accurate. It just means that people think about how to mitigate and minimize warfare between nations. Now, both of these fields, peace studies emerges out of international relations as a subfield, primarily post-World War II in the 50s and 60s. So as you know, that really shakes the Western world and kind of holds the mirror up to them and says, you know, how do you make sense of the crimes of the Holocaust in particular? And people really focus on trying to think, how can we imagine a world beyond war? So the Holocaust is really central in the study of peace studies because it's this rupture, well, this supposed rupture for the Western world. It is, of course, if you're a post-colonial scholar, not at all a rupture. So people have theorized the history of the Holocaust as being actually one that is a continuity of other forms of practices of extermination, so that the Holocaust is not an exception, but it is, in fact, the practice that Europe engaged in other parts of the world that then comes home to Europe itself. Now, people, particularly in Germany, will have feelings around that, making that comparison. But for a lot of memory scholars these days as well, they say we cannot really understand the crimes of the Holocaust without understanding how extermination camps, concentration camps were practiced in places like Africa. I will talk quite a bit about Palestine. I initially wrote for my talk that I'm going to focus on Gaza, but actually most of what I have is focused on the West Bank because that's where I have experience. I've never been to Gaza, but I spent years in the West Bank. But it doesn't really actually matter because all of Palestine presents this exception. And all of Palestine is really complicated because it blurs these notions of these really simplistic dichotomous notions of what war is on what peace is. Now, if you wanted to get really nitty gritty, international relations and peace studies define war and they define armed conflict. Those are not the same thing, right? Like war is between two recognized entities. So if you wanted to call out the state of Israel and what's currently happening in terms of definitions, it is quite easy. Because when we talk about warfare, we have to have recognizable entities. An armed conflict is a conflict between entities and requires at least 1,000 civilian deaths. So there are different distinctions. And peace often in international relations is about stability and the absence of war. Now, in peace studies, war is not defined that way. War is defined as exceeding just the presence of direct violence. And I'll talk about why that matters. Now, I've written how both of these fields and Western scholarship in particular, which I am part of, I'm trained in the West, I'm a German citizen, I have received all of my training in Western countries. Most of what I know about the world I've learned from Western scholarship. As much as I would like to say we've all been on a journey of decolonization, that didn't start for me until much later in my university years. So all of that is shaped by how we think about the world, right? So this is the Global Peace Index, which is a website that organizes the globe by which countries are peaceful. And blue is very high and red is very low. And you can see the state of peace in, this is not a great map, I understand it's not very accurate, but just for you to see how how we imagine peace, and that it has other criteria apart from the absence of open warfare and armed conflict. So it looks at levels of democracy, freedom of speech, journalistic freedom, etc. So it tries to capture this idea of peace with beyond what is just war. But as you can see, it creates real geographies of where we think violence is located. So when I did my PhD, I chose to write about racism in the West as a form of conflict, which was at that time very strange for a lot of people, because in peace and conflict studies, you would go and you would study a conflict usually located in the global South as a person who was located in the global North. And then you would make sense of how these people fight each other and how we can make sense of that. So people look at armed conflict, transitional justice, peace education, and so forth. And as a European of color, I always had issues with that because I thought the way people of color experience Europe is very different from how Europeans who are white experience Europe. And racism is such a form of structural and direct violence and is so under-researched in peace studies. So I started looking at race and racialization. And the more I looked at how peace studies and politics imagines violence and war, the more I came to see that it has real geographic locations. And the people in those geographic locations then themselves become representative of that violence, right? Not only is violence located where you live, but you by extension become a representation of that violence. And those people then also become seen as expressions of violence as they move across the globe, right? So that brown people, black and brown people are seen to be more of a physical threat or as a symbolic threat to these notions of law and order.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
Now, this is a picture by my friend Aisha. You can see her work on her website, aishamershani.com. She spent pretty much around the same time as I in the West Bank and took a number of photographs. This is of Lifta. Lifta is a former Palestinian village that was abandoned when people were displaced during the Nakba. It is fairly intact until today, so you can go visit and you can see the remnants of the presence of people. It was proposed to turn this into an upscale neighborhood, an extension of Jerusalem in 2012, which was rejected at the time. But it is about how we just imagine these places as being occupied by certain people, and then sometimes how we imagine these spaces to be empty, when really there's all of these layers of violence on them. So I have lots of Aisha's pictures throughout my presentation. Now, I'll play you a video before I talk about Palestine. Is this gonna work? This is Josep Borrell. I just wrote about this in a...
Yes, Europe is a garden. We have built a garden. Everything works. It's the best combination of political freedom, economic prosperity, and social cohesion that the humankind has been able to build. There's three things together. And here, Bruges is maybe the good representation of beautiful things, intellectual life, well-being. The rest of the world, and you know very well, Federica, is not exactly a garden. The rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, is a jungle. And the jungle could invade the garden. And the gardeners should take care of it.
So this is before Gaza. So I recently wrote a chapter where I basically compare the speech that Borrell gave to kind of these imaginations that we have, right? Like Europe imagines itself very much. And when I say Europe, I also mean the European settler colonies by extension, is really imagined as the center of peace and democracy inherently, right? Like Europe is where peace resides and conflict is somewhere else. It is the garden and the rest of the world is a jungle. And of course, who lives in Europe and who lives in the jungle, which I think, if you think about colonial writing, is quite representative about bestial beings that live in the colonies and the civilizing mission of the Europeans. But it is also very much in line with between this tweet that some of you may have seen, which was has since been removed, right? So this is by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, where he describes what is currently unfolding in Gaza as a struggle between the children of light and the children of darkness, between humanity and the law of the jungle. Now, not saying that Josep Borrell makes these arguments in line with Benjamin Netanyahu. He does not. You know, it took him a long time to speak out on what's happening in Gaza, but he has repeatedly criticized Israeli actions and called for the use of restraint and appropriate use of force, and I put this in quotation marks. But the geographies that we are imagining in both of these statements are very much the same, right? They are aligned with a space that is civilized, a space that is protected, a space that has peace, and a space that is uncivilized, that has violence, that has disorder and chaos. And inherently, those distinctions are very racialized, right? So the way Europe imagines itself is very white. The way Israel imagines itself is so too, even though Israelis aren't necessarily white in the same way as white people are. And I think that's really an important distinction to make, right? So the creation of Israel comes out of white supremacy and politics of extermination. But at the same time, it is now built on a very racialized social order in which people who are Palestinian or Bedouin or Black Israelis are not necessarily treated the same way as those who are Ashkenazi Jews. Having said that, I don't think we should equate the Jewish experience with whiteness per se, because anti-Semitism is real. Having grown up in Germany, I can tell you how real it is even today. But it does create these exceptions to itself, right? Like this very racialized world order that requires, as Rick Sibby would say, a constant controlling and maintaining. So Rick Sibby's work is actually focused on Eastern Europe and how Europe really struggles with how to make sense of European Muslims. Okay, so the Muslims in the Balkans, particularly Roma Muslims. So it's like Europe kind of creates this cordon where it has to maintain borders of whiteness, which is why Ukrainians post-war were seen as white, but Ukrainians when they're migrant workers in Germany and picking our asparagus were not, right? So it's by extension constantly having to navigate how it encloses, how it maintains the white enclosure. Now, I am cynical about this because in the history of Europe, war is actually not so far removed from us. So war isn't, our last war is not the Second World War. Right, Europe has been involved in wars ever since. We've had the wars in ex-Yugoslavia in the as you know recent as the 1990s. We're currently participating in arming Ukraine, so we're not removed from war. We have participated in the war in Afghanistan, even though we did not participate officially in the war on Iraq. We gave the U.S. permission to use all of its military bases in Germany have overflight rights. So we have been in a state of war, as most of the European countries in some way or another. The United States in the history of as being an independent nation has only had 15 years in which it has not engaged in warfare. Yet we imagine those places, if I go back to the peace index, as being places that are not at war because war does not happen on their territory. So I think it does help us to shift this understanding of where do we imagine peace and violence. So in peace studies, we're slightly different, as I said, from international relations. We'd like to think we're a little bit better. I say this with a lot of cynicism, because we distinguish between forms of violence that are direct violence, so not just war and armed conflict, but we also recognize cultural violence and structural violence. So poverty and racism and patriarchy and so on would be forms of structural violence. So therefore, we think the absence of violence in the direct shape is just a negative piece. And the presence of justice would then make a positive peace. And that's often attributed to a Norwegian scholar called Johan Galtung. That's not who came up with that. So here's where the term negative peace is actually used prior to Galtung using it. And it's from the letter to Birmingham Jail. People familiar with? If you haven't, it's not very long. I recommend reading it. So it's a letter that Martin Luther King writes to white church leaders who write him when he's incarcerated and say, you know, urge him to change his tactics and urge him to you know, change the pace of the way direct action is taking place in the civil rights movement. And he writes, "I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride towards freedom is not the white citizen's councillor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice." I teach this letter in most of my peace and conflict studies classes. It is timeless. It is very good. If you do racial justice, I always come back to this letter because people love to whitewash MLK. But it's also very confronting for people to see that he actually compares white moderate church leaders who are very openly on the side of the civil rights struggle, but very openly opposed to the tactics of the civil rights struggle as the main problem to achieving justice. And I brought this here because I think the way peace is understood today is very similar as it was understood back then. It's understood as law and order, as upholding the peace in the sense that it doesn't make people uncomfortable, but it's also not disruptive and inherently there's no use of violence. Now, I think it's very hard to overcome structural oppression and injustice or genocide without engaging in any form of violent resistance. Now, I don't believe particularly in the use of force myself on a personal level, but I do think that we need to be very cautious when we compare the protests of people in the UK who shut down a weapons company to the use of force by the police or by the military. Those are not the same types of force. And oftentimes, this equation is the one that distracts us from why people are doing what they're doing. So I'm not talking here about the use of lethal force or terrorism and things like that. I am talking about protest movements and how they engage in disruption of traffic, of destruction of property, or verbal harassment of politicians and so on. And then equating that with police force or the force of a military, okay? So now, let's imagine the globe slightly differently. Right? So you saw the map of where peace resides, the peace index, arms suppliers, and where the arms go that the West creates. So if we reverse that map, the peace map, and would track it against the mapping that people do that want to know where do our arms come from and where do our arms go and which conflicts do they feel, it does look very different, right? So the places that would have been in blue in the peace index map are the places that are some of the biggest arms dealers in the world. So they fuel those conflicts elsewhere. They create those supposed jungles elsewhere. And then they create really fortified borders around their own countries to just make sure that none of that jungle encroaches back onto the garden. I have issues with that garden analogy because in order for you to have a controlled garden, it requires a great deal of violence. But I just keep using it because it's just become this thing that I do, not talking about gardens and jungles when I talk about Europe. You know, Europe is the garden. Europe, in some way, is actually the enforcer of some of the biggest violence that we see in the world, particularly if you think about arms export, but also that the Mediterranean Sea is the world's deadliest border. The world's deadliest border. Right? So for Europe to enforce itself, to close off the garden to all of these encroaching little people from the jungle, it has to create little passages of death so that people cannot come in. And then it has to enforce that also within. Because the people who come from the outside, they look a lot like some people who are already in the garden. And then sometimes we can't tell the difference. So we just police all of our racialized populations as if they are these external enemies.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
So again, when we want to think about structural violence, the structural violence of militarization is one of the biggest problems that we see in the world. It is also the military. Militarization is one of the biggest polluters, one of the biggest problems to climate change. Right? So don't worry about having it keep cup. You would be much better off advocating against the end of militarization than doing most of those kind of like end consumer choices. By all means, please have your keep cup. I don't want you to. But so we don't necessarily see that in the climate movement either, right? The US military is one of the biggest polluters, but it's not just the US military. Militarization is killing the planet at a much higher rate than our fast fashion is. So there is a connection between multiple forms of oppression. The same goes, I would say, for capitalism, right? Like, because militarization is very, very intrinsically linked to capitalism, and capitalism also is terrible for the climate and for people. Now, what does peace and conflict's geographies neglect is that war also takes place within the garden. So this is from the raids in the Uruvedas. So this is, if you're interested, watch the documentary Operation 8 if you haven't yet. This is militarized police stopping undocumented street vendors in Spain. So they're selling counterfeit clothing in the street. This is from Black Lives Matter protests in the States, and so is the picture above. Now, I included the picture on the top right, which is just a woman in a dress confronting riots police, because that's how people love to represent standing up to oppression, right? This is what we have to do in order to resist for that to be palatable, right? This is what our resistance has to look like. It has to be ideally pretty, completely nonviolent, non-threatening, but we don't quite like the images of people, you know, pushing and fighting back, because somehow our innocence relies on never engaging in anything that could disrupt the rule of law or the state of peace, which I think is really complicated. And I have had to do a lot of unlearning, because I used to be one of those people who always thought, oh, we need to be really good in the way we protest and walk the moral high ground, because A, it's very hard to stand up against the institutions of the state when you get in trouble. But then also because I thought we can't engage in the forms of action that we are criticizing. So we can't really use violence if we're fighting against violence. Now I've come to realize it doesn't really matter what you do if you're a big group of people and you sit somewhere, it's already disruptive. And it's your presence that disrupts. It's not really what you do that disrupts. For me, it was these issues that led me to do my PhD on forms of Western violence. Because I thought, this is what I think of when I think of Europe. And when I think of Europe, I don't necessarily think, oh, okay, here's democracy, here are the institutions of human rights, right? Like, I thought, here are all the ways in which Europe commits human rights violations that go unnoticed, because we do have better democratic institutions and better democratic practices in other countries. But it doesn't mean that your rights don't get violated. And it also doesn't mean that every citizen is equal within those states. And drawing from a abolitionist organization in the States that fights police brutality and prisons, they say that militarization in the West has really imagined internal enemies the way it engages with external enemies in foreign countries. And you can see the way in which arms, vehicles, technology, training that comes from the military is now informing our policing in urban areas, which used to not be like that at all. So you have tanks in streets, you have riot police, you have police in full gear, and they make use of that, right? So I think if you don't want to go so far away to Europe or the United States, the way people showed up in the Uruvedas, which is a very rural community I really hope you all know where that is there was, you know, dozens of police cars and hundreds of police officers that knocked on people's door in the middle of the night. That's a choice. That is a very deliberate choice, right? To terrorize people and pull them out of their beds because they're seen as terrorists, right? So this rural Maori community suddenly presented a bigger threat and had to be confronted with the most militarized police force. Very similar when I see 16 police cars showing up to the Palestine rallies. I find that really interesting. It's a really interesting choice. And also how, this is when I regret saying some things that's going to be recorded, but it's really interesting how people respond to agitation that happens within the rally than to agitations that happen on the outside, right? And they're like, oh, we're just here, we can't do anything. And I'm like, but if you have a protester on the outside who's being really bigoted and really hateful and just keeps going, like some of the people from Destiny's Church that show up and blast, you know, hatred at people, or the woman with her Bible, she's actually been present last couple of weeks, who's really, really hostile and is really looking for confrontation, and to see that the police only shows up to contain the pro-Palestine people. Those are the ways I think you can see very, very clearly where people locate problems. Okay, who is seen to be the problem? In all of this, what has been absent in the way people have imagined peace and conflict is that they start in a very Western post-nation state context. They take the nation state, the Westphalian nation state, as the beginning. They look at Western understandings of sovereignty, so state sovereignty, and they do not look at what violence existed beforehand. So colonization is, for example, not at the center of how peace studies looks at where violence emerges. So when I did my PhD, I thought, oh, actually, colonization is war. Like, all of colonization is a form of warfare. Turns out other people think that too. And Nelson Maldonado Torres, who's a philosopher, describes basically colonialism and imperialism as this endless war. Right? This endless war of endless restructuring, endless forms of oppression and dehumanization. So he says, for people to justify colonization and then imperialism probably in the modern age is to constantly put in question some people's humanity. Right? So Europe is the center of peace and democracy, and it's the center of human rights. But really, before 1945, we did not necessarily have a clear universal understanding that all people had rights. In 1945, the vast majority of Asia and Africa was still colonized. So we get the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at a time where colonial subjects are not fully recognized. Right? So again, very cynical about some of these Western structures that we have come up with. So colonization does that for us, and it's enshrined into the system through racialization. Right? It's race that helps us make people suspend or put in question their sense of humanity. Right? So it's really about how do you make a war that people imagine to have never happened because they don't think colonization is a form of violence. They like to locate it neatly in the past. It's over, so it has no repercussions today. How do you think about violence and peace if we start from that point of view? So then who gets to be human? I love the idea of universal rights. I really do. I think it would be great if we had that notion. I just don't think that the institutions that we have and the documents that we have actually guarantee that. And we can see that very, very much. If we had universal human rights, there would be no need to say Black Lives Matter. There would have been no need for people in the civil rights movement to walk on the street with banners that said, I am a man. Right? You only have to affirm that you are a person when your personhood is in question. Palestinians only have to say we are human when their humanity is being suspended. Right? So we can see that in the colonial context, this notion of who gets to be human is fundamental. So when Columbus arrives and encounters indigenous people, he describes them as a people without a soul. Now, this is not a, day and age of philosophy and politics. It's a day and age of theology. So for us to make sense of other people is, do they believe in God? Do they have the same God? And that's how we know that they are like us, right? So when he says these are people without a God, he says these are people without a soul. So these are not people. And also he writes, they have no sense of private property. And that has to be justified. And it wasn't that we can say, oh, back then they did not know. That is also inaccurate, because every time people have tried to justify forms of violent behavior, there has been resistance to it. So in 1555, Spain has a really big debate between two monks who argue whether or not indigenous people can be seen as people. Right? Really big debate that happens inside Spain to say, are indigenous people natural slaves? As some people argue, can we oppress these people and exploit them and so on? And some people are like, no, these are people. Right? But the debate actually is not about indigenous people being like Europeans. As one person argued, they're like children. They can be converted to Christianity and then they can be saved. And the other person was like, no, they're not really people, they're natural slaves. Right? So that debate happened in the mid-1550s. And then, of course, the conclusion was they can be converted to Christianity and they can be saved, but then what do we do with the labor that needs to be done for us to exploit the resources in the Americas? And that's when transatlantic slave trade begins, because then Black people's humanity is fundamentally questioned. So race is a real marker here for people to be hierarchically organized. And even though we don't do it like that anymore, we don't say you're inherently inferior, you're genetically inferior like the Nazis would have done, the ways in which race organizes people functions along those lines. And you may remember from the Russian war in Ukraine, which is ongoing, the media coverage of some journalists that say these are people who look like us, but this is not the Middle East where people have been fighting each other for centuries, which is also very inaccurate. I don't want to hear that. Like, people in the Middle East haven't been fighting each other for centuries. Historically inaccurate. But it is about something about how, who do we recognize as similar to us? Who do we recognize? Whose pain do we recognize? Who gets to be innocent?
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
So this is one of Aisha's building of the separation wall that started being built in 2003, and parts of it weren't finished when this picture was taken, which was in 2005. And that one is from me. It's a photo collage. It was kids playing in a refugee camp, and a picture out of the checkpoint in Hebron, which is one of the most segregated towns in the West Bank, where settlers live in the middle of a Palestinian town. So I say this because the coverage of what is happening in Gaza has been so focused on what happened on October 7th, and the gruesomeness of October 7th. I don't think we need to question that. And to say, oh, some people have the right to live in peace. Israelis have the right to live in peace. Israelis have a right to self-defense. They have a right not to experience violence. They have a right for their civilians to be saved, to be safe. But Palestinians don't really ever, right? Like, Palestinians don't necessarily have a right ever to defend themselves. They don't have a right to live in peace because somehow their existence is already violence, right? The fact that they exist is constructed as this problem to begin with. And we see that all the time, even in how supposedly, I can't believe I say this now, but I'm also very over people saying we kind of have objective media, and to put everybody who's critical of mainstream media in the down the rabbit hole conspiracy theorist people. But, you know, people were still saying, oh, Al-Shifa Hospital got bombed just because there were tunnels underneath Al-Shifa Hospital. So does that make it okay? Like, does one thing make it okay? Does the fact that, you know, maybe there are tunnels, does that make it okay killing thousands of people? Somehow it does for some people, right? So I think this question of universality has been exposed as such a farce. There's a very great tweet that I like that said, you know, the other thing that died in Gaza was the myth of Western universalism. Now, I don't know who here has heard of a Palestinian prisoner who recently passed away. You should check out his writing, very beautiful writing by Walid Dakka. He died in prison before his sentence was served in the West Bank. And the Israeli state is not releasing his body until he has completed his sentence, which will be in 2025. Now, that is also not new. Israel has a long history of how it uses prisoners to punish families, and collective punishment is also not new at all in the context of the Israeli occupation. So I ask myself, right, like, who gets to be innocent? So even after serving your time, Palestinian, even dead bodies don't have rights. So then how do we rethink this question of peace? So I was invited to write a chapter on decolonization and peace. And I said, I am sorry, I find this is not the time. Because it feels, it just feels so naive to talk about peace in this particular moment. So I have a quote here from Kwame Ture who says, you know, you can have peace, but you can have injustice. So again, while I think this is kind of this notion of negative peace, there's something to be said about eliminating these fundamental structures of violence that is a prerequisite. We can't talk about peace if these structures of violence are still intact. And imperialism is one of them, colonialism is another one, I would say the patriarchy is another one, heterosexism. So we can't really think of peace as long as we have these structures in place. And we can't really think of peace at all without the question of reparations. Right? Everybody wants to talk about how to live next to each other. But how do you repair? I mean, just the material damage that has been done to Gaza, that's one thing. And the other is, how do you ask a population that has been terrorized, that is living through a genocide, how do you ask them and say, now come to the table and you tell us what you are going to do to uphold the end of the bargain. Right? I find that it's very, very strange that this is our understanding of how peace comes about. So I went to Palestine in 2003, as I said at the beginning. I'm a post-Oslo child in some ways. I grew up in a moment where it was on the table to imagine peace for most people, as cynical as we were about the Oslo peace process at the time. But we would have peace camps that we would go to, and it would be Israelis and Palestinians and international young people. And we really thought, oh, wow, one day down the line when these politicians get better and people get, you know, less greedy, it's on the table. And I talked to one of the people that I met many, many years ago this winter, well, last winter, Euro summer, and we talked to each other and we had a chat about how we were so idealistic when we met 20 years prior. And I messaged her very recently and I said, in these 22 years of my life, and I've always been very skeptical of the Israeli state, I don't think the Israeli state has ever pursued peace in the sense of wanting to coexist with Palestinians, not to control and oppress Palestinians. I did not see what's happening coming. Most Palestinians I know, even when they imagine the worst, could not imagine this degree of violence, right? So how do we talk about peace without actually engaging in forms of what are people allowed to do to liberate? So I have some examples from the past. So I don't know, this is again, you will see how old I am. The Bandung Conference in 1955, the non-aligned movement. So some countries who were like, we don't want to be part of this, these, you know, two big blocks fighting each other. We're going to kind of do our own thing. They conceptualized violence and peace very differently from the way the US and the USSR did at the time. And here I have a quote from Indonesia's prime minister at the time, who argued peace needs to eliminate fear and repression, right? Where he's pointing to the illusions of colonialism. Again, most countries here still experiencing colonization. So he also pointed out that peace required a number of preconditions, such as the willingness and determination of living neighborly together, irrespective of each other's political, social, or religious ideologies, on the principles of mutual respect for each other's national sovereignty and each other's territorial integrity. So again, this has been a place where countries in the global south are fighting for independence from their colonial administrators. Okay? So they actually position in this particular conference peace as a precondition and a consequence of decolonization and national self-determination. In the US, we also had in the 1950s, the We Charge Genocide Convention, where black activists basically take the US, will charge the US with genocide against black people. I think that's really important because people have tried to do the same now. So there's another convention that people brought forward by saying that the way the US engages in border control is very similar. And these peace activists were persecuted by the state. Some of them had their passports confiscated. They had to go into exile. They were subject to state surveillance. They were constructed as enemies within. Okay, so there's people like Claudia Jones, W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson. Same thing if we think of Black Lives Matter today, how initially when Black Lives Matter kind of erupted in 2020, how a lot of those protests were framed as looting, violence, forms of like guerrilla warfare, etc., etc. Okay, so my friend describes war colonialism and racialized oppression are therefore mutually constitutive. This is another picture by Aisha, and this is in one of the villages that would have weekly nonviolent protests against the construction of the wall. So that's a group of women with white banners at the end. So this is all happening around 2005, 6, 7, where this was the reality of how people responded to nonviolent protest. So if you're interested in knowing more about that, there's a good film called Budrust that covers one of the villages and their nonviolent resistance. So for Palestinians, it hasn't really mattered how they fight back, whether it's violently, symbolically, through the use of terrorism. It's always been faced with violence. So this is a mural that San Francisco State University put up of the scholar Edward Said, which resulted in 2012, I want to say, It was a huge scandal. It was framed as making Jewish students unsafe. It was framed as being anti-Semitic. People threatened to take it down. This is just a mural, people, yeah? No actual people. And similarly, when Israel annexed the West Bank in 1967 and banned the Palestinian flag and the Palestinian colors, which is when the watermelon came out. So that somehow red, green, white, and black became so threatening to the occupying forces, so threatening that it had to be banned. And that's where the Palestinians would cut open a watermelon and use the watermelon. So if you've ever wondered where the sign of the watermelon came from, post-1967, because they banned anything that had the Palestinian flags, not just the flag itself, any combination of those colors, right? So again, these things are presented as forms of violence, right? The mural is making people feel unsafe. It's supposedly communicating harmful, hateful messages. The watermelon now is a sign of resistance. And when I say resistance, we like that word, but when you're under occupation, resistance is you're part of the resistance, therefore you become a target.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
Now, Germany, Berlin, my old hometown, has nothing but great news. Germany yet again on the, wrong side. It sent out a letter to parents. This is right shortly after October 7th, to inform the parents of how to maintain the school peace, right? And it says, the principal points out how to manage responses from students. The letter read that given Berlin's diverse student body, fostering tolerance and embracing diverse viewpoints is integral to the educational mission. Okay. However, such tolerance has its limits when it comes to supporting violence and propaganda that supports terrorist violence. Consequently, the school district felt the need to inform parents and students of the guidelines to maintain school peace. Any demonstrative actions or expression that can be interpreted as advocating or endorsing attacks on Israel or supporting the terrorist organizations conducting them, such as Hamas or Hezbollah, are prohibited in the current situation as they pose a threat to the school's peace. This not only includes carrying symbols, making gestures and expressions, expressing opinions. This can include wearing relevant clothing items, including the keffiyeh, so this little scarf, displaying stickers with inscriptions like Free Palestine, or a map of Israel in the colors of Palestine, or shouting slogans like Free Palestine. So in this context, the existence of Palestinians is already violent. This is no joke, people. Germany has taken this to a whole level of, a level not even I could have imagined. But again, it equates, right? It equates even the support for terrorist organizations. So it doesn't say, oh, don't come with the Hezbollah flag. It says, don't come wearing a keffiyeh. Don't have a sticker that says Free Palestine. There used to be bars in Berlin where you couldn't go inside with the keffiyeh way before October 7th, because it was framed as being inherently anti-Semitic. So again, it's really about becoming attuned to how people imagine peace and violence and where they locate violence onto people. Now, on a final note, so I think for us to think about abolition, people are familiar with abolitionist theory, mainly focus on prisons and police, but abolitionist theories also focus on militarization. This is from a fantastic Twitter site called Ruth Wilson Gilmore Girls, where they take quotes from the Marxist scholar, abolitionist scholar Ruth Wilson Gilmore, and juxtapose them on images from Gilmore Girls. Fantastic Twitter. And Ruthie says, really, when we think of abolition, we only need to change one thing, and that thing is everything. And that abolition isn't about getting rid of things. It's not just about dismantling the structures of the police and the structures of prisons and the structures of the military, but it's about building life-affirming institutions. So I think for me, a world without war is possible, but it can only be done if we don't think about pacifism as turn the other cheek, but we think about abolition as justice, reparations, getting rid of racial capitalism, and not trying to eradicate tension. Tension isn't the problem to peace. It's how the problem is manifested. So when people fight, we have to ask ourselves why they fight. When people are angry, we have to ask ourselves why they're angry. And we have to be very, very wary when people are trying to tell us that some protesters somewhere in Littleton are a bigger threat to our state of peace than more bombs being dropped on Gaza than have been dropped on Hiroshima. So I think it's just these tactics of distraction and how we've just been conditioned to see the violence of the pirate and never the violence of the emperor, or the violence of the jungle and never the violence of the garden. Because we are so good at that. Like, I think Western institutions and Western countries have become so good at sterilizing their own violence and externalizing it. So that we do need to bring it home sometimes. We need to make that visible, which is quite hard. I would like to end on a hopeful note. It's very hard, I find, to promise you something that you can do when you go away. But I think being angry is one thing, is a very good thing at the moment. To be enraged by injustice means that we do something about it. But I have found for me, I've returned to abolition because I thought I need something to focus on where my energy can go. And I thought disestablishing the structures that oppress us and building institutions that are based on mutual care and mutual aid and sustainable ways of living is maybe the way to go. And I see a tiny bit of hope when we see all of these struggles coincide, when we see what's happening here, the attack on treaty, coincide with people showing up for Palestine, with people showing up for climate. As I think when all of that comes together, then there is real power for change. But if you go away, just point, like, just watch how people create these geographies of peace and violence in your everyday life, and it will really transform the way you look at the world and where you think problem populations reside. We do that also with poverty people. Like, it's not just with racialized people in the global south. We do the same thing with poor people. Somehow they've brought it upon themselves to be poor, and therefore we can just punish them. So yeah, I don't know how long I spoke, but this is it.
That was Martis Azamandi on interrogating notions of peace against a backdrop of genocide and colonial violence in Palestine. If you are interested in more talks of this nature, or workshops and film screenings that build resistance to colonial injustice in Aotearoa and abroad, please follow us on Instagram or check our website for further events. Our current exhibition, Distance is a Blade, features works by Akil Ahmat, Olivia Hong, and Yumoy Jing. Comprising videos, sculpture, and wall-based works, the exhibition contends with intimacy and alienation, love and rupture, and the private and effective forms of myth-making that carry us into the future. Drawing on autobiography, pop culture, customary storytelling, and forms of online encounter, the works invite us into dreamlike sequences where animals and atmospheric effects collide with intensely human dramas. In each of the artist's works, the sharpness of separation and longing becomes something to hold fast to, an edge upon which to endlessly remake ourselves anew. The exhibition is open Tuesday to Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., and Saturdays and Sundays, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. here at the Physics Room on 301 Montreal Street, Ōtautahi, Christchurch. Distance is a Blade closes on Sunday, the 19th of May, 2024. I hope you will come and visit the show. Thank you for listening, and tune in next month on Friday, the 17th of May at 8 p.m. for our next episode of Art Not Science. Mā te wā.
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, and the Crater Rim.